Luke 9, 28 to 36, and it's on the inside sheet of your handout. About 8 days after Jesus said this, he took Peter, John, and James with him and went up onto a mountain to pray. As he was praying, the appearance of his face changed, and his clothes became as bright as a flash of lightning. Two men, Moses and Elijah, appeared in glorious splendor, talking with Jesus. They spoke about his departure, which is about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. Peter and his companions were very sleepy, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. As the men were leaving Jesus, Peter said to him, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what he was saying. While he was speaking, a cloud appeared and covered them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. A voice came from the cloud saying, "This is my son, whom I have chosen. Listen to him." When the voice had spoken, they found that Jesus was alone. The disciples kept this to themselves and did not tell anyone at that time what they had seen.
Well, can I have my welcome? It's lovely to see you here this lunchtime. My name's Richard Bray, and I'm one of the leaders of these lunchtime talks. And we've been working through this chapter of Luke's Gospel and seeing that Christianity is more radical than we think. We said last week that every movement in history has a strong man, sometimes a woman, but usually a man, a strong man at its head, one who is powerful, who conquers on behalf of his followers. And often people are very happy to identify Jesus as their strong man, the one they look to for help, the one they're willing to call the Christ. Maybe your view of Jesus is a bit like what I've got here. This is my Jesus action figure. My wife bought this for me a few years ago. Jesus action figure. It says with poseable arms and gliding action, not suitable for children under 3 years. Is your view of Jesus a bit like that? A sort of mystical, powerful man who is useful to have on your side, especially maybe in a tight spot. Is that your view of Jesus Christ, I wonder? It seems like the disciples had a view of Jesus at this stage in the story a bit like that. We saw last week that they had come to see that Jesus is the ultimate strong man, the Christ, God's appointed ruler and rescuer. And yet we saw that as soon as they identified Jesus as the Christ, well, he went straight on to make the shocking claim that he is the Christ who must die. He's the Christ who must die. I wonder whether we can grasp just how shocking that is. What use is there in being the strong man, the Christ, if he's going to suffer and die? Especially if following him meant that they were going to suffer as well. We want to hitch our fortunes to a strong man who's going to be victorious, don't we? We want to find leaders in business life who will look out for our interests and promote us ahead of our peers. We follow the political leaders and the religious leaders who seem to promise the most satisfaction, whether that be in our finances or our spiritual happiness or in other ways. We're going to see that even for those of us who have been keen Christians for many years, we can find ourselves defaulting to a worldly view of Christianity, simply following the strong man Jesus, thinking that he'll bless us, but maybe missing some of the points. Jesus promises exactly the opposite to our natural worldly expectations of blessing from the strong man. He said, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me." I want us to grasp just how shocking that teaching is. We need to grasp how shocking it is so that we can be sure that we're not following a distorted version of Christianity that is all strongman and no suffering. The shocking claims that Jesus made last week help explain, I think, why today's Bible passage follows hard on its heels. The earthly realities of Jesus as the Christ who must die are followed today by a heavenly confirmation. This little episode that Andre's just read for us, it's on the sheet there, it's often called the transfiguration of Jesus as his appearance is changed on the mountain. It reassures his disciples and it reassures us today that Jesus is the Christ of heaven, the Son of Man. Everything about this experience is loaded with heavenly imagery. I don't know if you noticed that as Andre read it to us. Jesus goes up on a mountain, first of all, to pray. Mountains were regarded as closest to the heavens. You just need to think about Moses going up on the mountain to receive the law, or Elijah making a sacrifice on a mountain to defeat the prophets of Baal. And prayer is a question of speaking to the God of heaven, isn't it? The change in Jesus' appearance on the mountain with his supernaturally bright clothes shows the heavenly reality, a glimpse of Jesus' true glory. And the presence of two great prophets of long ago, Moses and Elijah, who now dwell with God, it all emphasizes the heavenly reality of the scene, doesn't it? And if we picture the heavens as being above the earth, well, it's natural that clouds are seen throughout Scripture as the meeting place between God and mankind. Again, we think of Moses up the mountain receiving the Ten Commandments in the thick clouds, or the cloud of God's glory filling the tabernacle, or in fact the clouds that took Jesus up at his ascension, and the clouds on which the Son of Man will be presented to receive his rule over all the nations. And then at the climax of this short episode, God himself speaks out of the cloud. It's down there in verse 35, in the middle of the second paragraph of the passage on your sheet. A voice came from the cloud saying, "This is my Son, whom I have chosen. Listen to him." Packed into those three short phrases are at least three Old Testament references. The idea of the Christ being the Son of, being God's Son, is from Psalm 2, where the Son is installed as King over all the nations. In Isaiah 42 and 49, God speaks about his servant as my chosen, the one who will bring justice and be a light of salvation to all nations. And in Deuteronomy chapter 18, Moses tells us that God will send another prophet like him who will speak in God's name and to whom we must listen. So the scene is a heavenly one, isn't it? A glimpse, as it were, of the eternal spiritual realities that exist alongside the earthy and shocking teaching of Jesus' sufferings. God's own voice is heard, confirming Jesus as the one in whom the promises of old would be fulfilled. This is much more the kind of strong man that the disciples were expecting. One who is at least equal to the great strong men of the Old Testament, Moses and Elijah. One who is glorious, who meets with God himself. This vision is meant to draw in and reassure all of God's followers. There's a little word there in verse 30 that's not actually translated in our version here, but it actually says, "Look," or "Behold, two men appeared in glorious splendor." We're meant to be drawn in and reassured by this vision. Peter, many years later, in his second letter in the New Testament, writes about this experience. He says, "We did not follow cleverly devised stories when we told you about the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ in power, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. He received honor and glory from God the Father when the voice came to him from the majestic glory. We ourselves heard this voice that came from heaven when we were with him on the sacred mountain." Jesus is confirmed as the Christ of heaven, the Son of Man. This experience, this vision would have been immensely reassuring to the disciples as they puzzled over Jesus' shocking words 8 days earlier. And yet the indications are here, even in this powerful heavenly confirmation, that Jesus is the Christ who must die. Peter's initial reaction to the vision is the reaction of one who is still wanting to preserve his strong man, to keep his powerful leader near him where he seems most useful to him. What did he say as Moses and Elijah looked like they were leaving? Verse 33, as the men were leaving Jesus, Peter said to him, "Master, it's good for us to be here. Let us put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." You see, he wanted to preserve the scene, didn't he? He wanted his master, the strong man, to be kept there in the presence of the strong men of old, accessible, visibly powerful, on tap when needed. "It's good for us to be here," he says. It's as if he wanted a bottled Messiah, one who conformed to all our assumptions about the strong man who never fades, who never goes away. A bit like my Jesus action figure. And yet Luke gently reminds us that Peter's perspective is not the right one. He and his companions have already been described as sleepy. And usually in the Bible stories, sleep is a metaphor for spiritual doziness. And then Luke adds an editorial note. "He did not know what he was saying." Don't listen to him, in other words. In fact, Peter's words conflict directly with what Jesus, Moses, and Elijah were saying, doesn't it? What were they talking about in verse 21? In verse 31? They were speaking about his departure, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. Peter said, "It's good for us to be here on this mountain." But Jesus and Elijah and Moses knew that Jesus had to go. They were speaking about his journey to Exodus, his journey to Jerusalem. The word departure there, they were speaking about his departure. It translates that Greek word Exodus. They were speaking about Jesus' Exodus. Now, we said last week that the Exodus in the Bible was the great model rescue of the Old Testament, where the Israelites were saved from slavery in Egypt through the sacrifice of a lamb. And Jesus, in Luke 9, as he was about to set his face to go to Jerusalem, was going there to fulfill the Old Testament promise of a second Exodus, as he was about to die as a sacrificial lamb on behalf of his people. So do you see? Even as the disciples were receiving this heavenly confirmation that Jesus is the true strong man, the Christ of heaven, the Son of Man who would inherit the nations, even in the midst of this confirmation, the clues are there, aren't they? If only they would see them, that Jesus is also still the Christ who must die. And of course, what was God's command as he spoke from the cloud and confirmed Jesus as his son, his chosen one? His command was, listen to him. It's a general command, of course. We must listen to everything Jesus says. But what specifically has Jesus been saying that we must listen to? Well, back in verse 22, which we looked at last week, Jesus said, "The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests and teachers of the law, and he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life." And we're going to hear from Jesus next week in verse 44. He says himself, "Listen carefully to what I'm about to tell you. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men." I wonder whether we're so fixed in our expectations about Jesus Christ, our strong man, our action figure, that we failed, like the disciples, to listen carefully to what kind of strong man he said he was going to be. The strong man who would be killed by men. The disciples didn't get it here, did they? How could Jesus be the strong man, God's appointed ruler and rescuer, and also at the same time be the one who must suffer and be killed? And I think we often struggle with the same difficulty today. I think maybe we have a sanitized, blunted, domesticated view of Jesus. The Jesus of the popular imagination isn't the transcendent, powerful Son of Man ruling the nations, but neither is he the pathetic, defeated, bloody sacrifice on behalf of sinners. Instead, Jesus is reduced to simply an example, a patron, a genie, one who we hope to receive good things from, an action figure with poseable arms and gliding action. But no, Christianity is more radical than we think. How can this apparent clash then between Jesus as the strong man and Jesus as the suffering man, how can they be resolved? Well, they're resolved for us in the same way that they were resolved in the end for the disciples. And that is through Jesus' resurrection from the dead. Because Jesus rose from the dead, we are reassured that his suffering and his death weren't the end. When Jesus rose from the dead bodily on the third day in history, he confirmed that the sacrifice had been successful. Death had been defeated. New life had broken in. And as he then ascended on the clouds to be with his Father in heaven, he was established as the one who rules all the earth, invisibly today, but who will come again in power to bring justice on all nations and to save everyone who will accept him. The part of Jesus' teaching in Luke 9 which receives the least attention is actually the bit that makes sense of all the rest. He said that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. He was raised imperishable, transformed, the ruler of the nations. And so if you're here today and you're yet to make up your mind about Jesus Christ, who he is and what he came to do, will you look at his resurrection from the dead in particular? That was where I was encouraged to look as a 19-year-old looking into these things for the first time, to look at the evidence for Jesus' resurrection. It might be that you've always held Jesus in some sort of respect as a good moral guide, even as someone powerful and worth associating with. But maybe you've never really seen that he must be rejected and killed, the sacrifice who brings the true exodus. Maybe neither have you grasped the great glory of him as the Christ of heaven, the risen Son of Man, the ruler of all the earth. Will you look at the resurrection then? The evidence that proves Jesus' words to be true, that demonstrates his identity once for all. Will you do that? Do speak to me or speak to a Christian friend afterwards if you'd like to know how to go about doing that. Many of us, I know, though, have already believed, and so I want us to return to the implications for us once we have believed in who Jesus is, in his suffering and in his glory. You see, Jesus is the Christ who must die, and therefore we face the radical call, we must die for him. Our fortunes are hitched, aren't they, to the strong man that we follow. When David Moyes took over at Manchester United, he cleared out Alex Ferguson's right-hand men and brought in his own backroom team, might think today that that was a mistake. When there's a takeover at work, often there's a clear out of senior management, isn't there? As the new strongman brings in his own people, you see our fortunes are hitched to the strongman that we follow, whichever sphere of life we're talking about. So just the same, if we follow Jesus Christ, we follow his pattern, don't we, of suffering and death. If we follow him, we continue doing his work of making the kingdom of God known to all people. And we face the same persecution that he suffered. His death and resurrection and ascension mean that he's left us now to continue his work of making his rule and his rescue known to all the nations. And that will mean that we face very often opposition, mockery, and loss in this life for the sake of following him. I wonder where it is that we fail to grasp the death and the new life of Christ now. I wonder whether we've been misled by our natural worldly assumptions about the strong man, imagining Jesus as a worldly Messiah. I think that can be a danger, particularly in parts of the Pentecostal movement. It's not true of all Pentecostals by any means. I know we've got some brothers and sisters from those sorts of churches among us. But there can be such an emphasis, I think, on the victory of Christ, the one who is powerful, the one who does all good things, that the assumption is if we follow him, then we will be blessed with health and wealth in this life now. And church life becomes built around the cult of the strong man, around Jesus as the ultimate strong man, but also our pastors need to be strong and successful too in their good suits and their expensive cars to demonstrate the power of Christ. And the heads of households and every member of the fellowship is expected to show those signs of success and blessing as well. But that church culture reflects worldly Christianity that denies Jesus' own teaching. Whoever would save his life will lose it. That doesn't mean that Jesus is not powerful, that he's not the Christ, but it does mean his rule is about more than our prosperity or our standing in this world here and now. We should expect to be worse off, materially and socially speaking, for the sake of following Jesus through the pattern of death that leads into new life. I wonder whether you can recognise that pattern of Christianity that I've described. Closer to home for some of us, for me personally and for others among us, in traditional British culture, I think there's a moderate, inoffensive Christianity that has Jesus as a respectable, authoritative cultural leader, one who instills in us honourable values and who will bless us if we follow him, if we do our bit for the local church, if we live a life that avoids outright scandal. And again, this social Christianity fails to grasp Jesus' own gritty teaching about what it means to follow him. Christianity is more radical than we think. Following Jesus may lead to financial ruin. It may lead to humiliation. For many around the world, even today, it leads to death. The head of the Church of Kenya, speaking just days after the shopping mall massacre in Nairobi last year, said this: "The nations which were once the spiritual powerhouses of worldwide mission, that's us, have now become deeply secularized and even hostile to the Christian faith. And the churches of those lands have more often than not been strongly influenced by the societies in which they're set. I am aware that for some of you, the threat of violence from Islamic extremism may be uppermost in your minds. And we've had a painful reminder of that reality recently here in Kenya. But that which really rots the fabric of the communion is the much more insidious process by which weak churches are gradually taken captive by the surrounding culture. Have you been taken captive by the cultural assumptions of how to get on in this life today? Has your Christianity been domesticated to be acceptable to our society? Unthreatening, inoffensive, neutered. What would it look like, I wonder, for you to adopt the radical Christianity of Jesus Christ, the strong man who suffered and died? Are you willing to stake everything on him and on making him known? Your finances, your reputation, your life itself. That might look very mundane, as the managers at work are trying to decide which of your cohort to keep on or to promote. Are you willing to be known as the Christian? Will you risk social death as you ask a colleague to read the Bible with you or to come along to a lunchtime talk? Will you make still more radical decisions about the future direction of your working life? I was speaking to a friend a little while ago about someone who was weighing up the cost of dropping her working hours to volunteer for her church. And my friend said this: tell her that her grandmother's generation would have been packing their possessions in a coffin to take the gospel to the nations. On the back page of your handout, you'll find, as usual, a couple of discussion questions and questions for reflection. And one of them says this: have you staked everything on following Jesus, the strong man who suffered and died? What are you holding on to in this life? Let's take a moment, shall we, just to start to reflect on that question, and then I'll lead us in.